Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Thanks, Mom. That was Mom out in the audience. She's the only one out there. Is that enthusiasm or what? I was looking up today that enthusiasm, the root word in Latin is the God within you. So thanks, Mom. Thanks for that enthusiasm. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which has closed in a bit. The GSO, that's not the KGB, but that's the General Service Organization of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the auspices of the Grapevine, which is our monthly meeting in print, has produced a sponsorship book. It's called One-on-One Sponsorship. The unique thing about this is that this is the first time this organization has done this in 78 years, which I think it's going to be a game changer, at least with the perception that sponsorship is coming back into the forefront of recovery, which is really what this is all about. One person talking to another person with a like type of illness. The one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH at Floyd Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, Arthur, Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society, of our nation, and of our country, if not the world. Most of the problems that we face today are because the children today, or their adults today, grew up as empty lot weed children, latchkey kids. Nobody was there to teach them these correct principles other than the groups and the gangs. Excuse me, a tremendous amount of peer pressure, drugs, alcohol, and illicit sex, of course, always goes along with drugs and alcohol, is all part and parcel of this phenomenon, this breaking of the social fabric. And drugs and alcohol play a major part in this phenomenon. It's an epidemic, folks. Some people acknowledge it, some people don't. They don't know what to do. You know, the war on drugs and all that. Well, we've lost the war. Thing now is education and a spiritual understanding of what this is all about, I believe. Harold also goes to the prisons, and he does a fine work in the prisons. He brings the message. He carries the message to the prisons. I'll tell you this, most of the folks in prisons are there as crimes of opportunity fueled by alcohol and drugs. There's some career criminals in there, and you're always going to find a horse thief that wants a free ride, but the vast majority are alcohol and drugs related. What we share in our meetings and in this program is our experience, strength, and hope. Our experience is an inventory of our past mistakes. That's how we relate to each other. Strength is the ability to lift or carry. We lift our fellows and we carry the message of recovery. That keeps us sober. And hope is the belief that our lives will continue to improve when we do the next right thing. And that next right thing is not to take that first drink of alcohol or hit of crack. The clean house is suggested in the 12 steps found in our basic text of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to trust in God and the process that he gave us. Harold, how you doing tonight?
Good evening, everybody, and thank you, Joseph, for that introduction. I'm doing great. I am really blessed. And I just wanted to take a moment to mention a couple of things. As I work with parents all the time, I try to explain the two huge assignments that parents have. Number one, to keep kids healthy and safe. Number two, to show the kids how to succeed in the real world, how to grow up to be godly young men and women. And so in pursuit of that, I also explain the three leading causes of death for young people 15 to 25 years old. Number one by far is car wrecks. So I encourage the parents to not get the kids a car when they're in high school. Please wait until they're going to college and they can really show some responsibility before you give them that freedom. They're dying in those cars. And the second cause, number two and three, are neck and neck, and they are suicide and AIDS. AIDS is still an epidemic in this country, although it doesn't make the news all the time, and a lot of people are dying of AIDS, and the young people, child suicide is on the rise. So a lot of that has to do with drugs and alcohol and the stress that young people are under. So I just want to encourage everybody to not only keep an eye out for drugs and alcohol, but also listen for the kids who are depressed and saying things that are suicidal. Pay attention to that. And please try to teach abstinence. There's no such thing as safe sex. Condoms fail 30% of the time. You can teach abstinence. It's taught in many places in the world, just not quite the emphasis here in the U.S. that I'd like to see. Let me mention to our listeners that the program and the website are not money-making propositions. We do this as a public service. In Joseph, not only doesn't Joseph make any money, but he spends a great deal of money making the website, rumradio.org, and the radio program, Rum Radio, happen. We're helping a lot of people. Most people listen on the archives, but we do have an opportunity to call in. If you'd like to call in, the call-in number is 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621. You can call in. You can also go to our website, rumradio.org, if you'd like to ask a question in the chat room. You can type in a question if you don't want to be on the air. And by calling in, you don't have to go on the air. You can just listen. Or you can press the number one and actually ask your question live. We're live on the radio in Nashville and surrounding areas, but and it also goes out live to Joseph's mom. So it's nice to be here. I consider it a privilege to serve. This is my way of giving back. This is Joseph's way of giving back. And as it is with our guest tonight, so I'll turn things back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. And as a disclaimer, this is not AA. Although I like using the big book, that's the primary information found in it's called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the primary edition of 12-step recovery, basic text. Why the big book? All 12-step recovery programs, no matter where, comes from the understanding in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we'll use that as a template, but this is not AA. This is not NA, Narcotics Anonymous. This is not CA, Cocaine Anonymous. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you can hang in there long enough with us, you might consider this as Narcoleptics Anonymous. Now, we should have a really good show tonight. I'm excited about our guest. I'd like, before I introduce Steve C., I'd like to say the third step prayer. It's one of the first assignments I give my sponsees. The third step prayer is found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of the first assignments I give to a new sponsee. I have them call around in their home group and ask a person on their list. I ask them to get a lifeline list in case I'm not available to them. The sponsor's not always available, so it's a good idea oftentimes to make sure that your sponsee has a list and a home group and to ask permission to say the third step prayer. And the reason why I do that, it gets them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. Thirdly, it connects him up with his fellowship. They get to know his name, and he gets to know their name. And fourthly, the person he's calling might have been thinking about picking up their first drink, their first hit of crack, or their first whatever. And the chances are they will not. There's no guarantees, but it gets your sponsee into service, which we found to be the key to this 12-step programs is service is the key in the lock of long-term, to maintain and attain long-term sobriety. So this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Do I get an amen on that?
Amen, amen, brother. Amen.
Thank you. Well, now I'd like to introduce our interview for tonight, Steve C. Great story. Steve has notoriety. I'm going to let him tell a story. I don't want to take his thunder away, but Steve has lost the ability to see, and because of an incident when he was incarcerated. Sight is probably 80 to 90% of most sensory input coming into the human mind comes from the eyes. And not having that is quite a challenge, to say the least. Steve has been able to overcome that and inspire thousands with his story. He's a very modest kind of guy, but I think you're going to be really interested to see what he has to say. So, Steve, tell us what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. Really appreciate it. I'm really honored, Harold and Joseph. Great introduction, great education, too, on both of you guys. I thought kind of y'all reading my mail when you mentioned a lot of those things about growing up and parenting skills and service work and things like that. I was like, wow, these guys really know exactly what to do and what to say and how to, you know, perform. Well, thank you for the introduction. I'll start out by mentioning my date, which is November 6, 1996. I got sober in prison while incarcerated, and I only had about 3 or 4 months of good eyesight before I started coming up with a lot of ailments in the back of my neck. I was a bodybuilder in prison. You know, there's nothing else to do in prison. I mean, really, you know, what else are you going to do in prison except watch TV and, you know, self-entertain yourself, if you know what I mean. So, I got bored of that, but I'd work out, you know, 8 hours a day. So I figured I was causing too much pain. So I quit working out, and then it kept coming back. And I lost 40 pounds of weight, and they chained me up and, you know, shackles and handcuffs and belt straps and take me to Oklahoma Moore Hospital in Oklahoma City. And they'd get through all these intern doctors that would check me out, and about every 3 weeks I was going from Boldy, Oklahoma, the prison, to OMH, and they would guess these, you know, problems, why I was losing weight, why I was having equilibrium problems, why I was having speech problems, and a little blurred vision, till finally the eighth doctor, which was at Boldy, was a psychologist, and he diagnosed me as a manic depressant, and I was like, okay, why is that? And he said, because you broke up with your girlfriend, I heard, and that's why you've been
going through all these physical problems. You know, it's mental. It's mental, you know. So he actually had me documented as a nut. And he sent me to Joseph Heart Correctional Facility, which is an E-unit called Fantasy Island. And I was there with all the other
That's
nuts.
Interesting.
In it? It really is. And I was there with a lot of really nuts, watching everybody doing the Thorazine shuffle. And I was having a lot of, you know, problems. I mean, I was throwing up blood because they were giving me Motrin. Now, they didn't tell me to take 800 milligrams four times a day, but take it on a full stomach. Well, I couldn't eat, you know, because of all the pain and discomfort in the back of my skull and everything. So they finally, after a month, they pulled me off the floor of my cell where I was just laying there on the coolness of the cement, laying my head against the concrete because it felt cool. And they picked me up and they took me back to OMH, and this time to all the psychologists there at Fantasy Island that watched me for weeks gambled and thought, you know, let's see if this actually is a really physical problem, you know, and not a mental psychosis of that he's, you know, manic depressive. And sure enough, they took a CAT scan, and the doctor, I'll never forget, walked over towards me, and I'm still chained up, sitting between two guards, and the nurse puts a pin in my hand and starts signing with my hand, and I'm looking at her, and I'm looking at him, and he's tapping me on the back of the skull and says, Mr. Crawford, we found out what's wrong with you. You have a hemoblastoma tumor right here. And I had a little speech impediment problem at the time. I looked up at him, had his red hair, Bermuda shorts, and a Hawaiian T-shirt. I'll never forget that. I don't know if they got this guy out of happy hour. I don't know. But he's a doctor. And I looked at him and said, what are you going to do? Give me some pills? You know, and he said, no, sir, in 2 weeks, you might be dead or you'll be a vegetable within 2 months for sure. And so I finished signing it myself. I stood up myself, walked over to that table, jumped on and looked at him and said, go ahead. I mean, it was the first time in many months, I think it was from March till September 17th of 1997 is when they did the operation. But I was suffering through all that pain that they finally discovered what the real deal was. And even though it was a brain tumor, I didn't even question, oh, brain, no, what were they going to, you know, I just, good, you found what's wrong, cut it out. And they did. And I pretty much 99% went blind. I woke up the next day in the recovery room. I saw there was somebody next to me. I couldn't tell. I said, could you turn the lights on? He said, the lights are on. I said, do you have a phone? And so he handed me a cell phone. First time I touched a cell phone, and he dialed my dad's number. I called him and told him, you know, that I just got a surgery. They found out I had a brain tumor, and then I get back to him. And then they kept me in there for about 6 days, and they sent me back to Fantasy Island for another week, and then they sent me back to Lexington Prison. While I was there in the infirmary, and that 1% that I had left that just got me able to move out of the bed to find the wall, to find the bathroom, that was gone. And that's when I kind of went into my state of shock. I was already in denial of what I was going through. I figured I'd snap out of it or something, you know, that this was a bad dream, or surely God would not do this to me. You know, I'm not a hideous raper or child molester or anything. You know, I'm just a hideous drunk drug addict. You know, surely God would do something like this to me. It's got to come back. But it never did.
You know, maybe that's a good point. I usually like to see what happened before that, though. Can we leave that and go back to the first time you realized that drugs and alcohol were your answer? And then we'll get back to that to see what your life looked like prior to this.
Prior to my blindness, while sober.
Yeah, in the beginning. Yeah. Give it like, how old were you the first time you got high?
Okay, I was. I was born in New York, and I lived there for quite a while. My parents divorced when I was really, really young, probably like 3, and I lived with my mother in Dallas. And with many boyfriends that she would tell me to call, you know, father and stuff like that. And they were very drunken, drug addict, abusive, physically beat the heck out of him all the time. So I ran away at the age of 11 in Dallas, Texas. And lived for a while in the streets. By the time I got up to Oklahoma and see my dad, I was pretty well drunk, drugs, messed up. And
how old were you?
When I started drugs, I was 12. I was easily 12. I mean, I would go into
marijuana or
store.
Heavier drugs?
Huh?
Marijuana or the heavier drug? Heavier drugs?
I started drinking. I started drinking. That was my relief. That was the first time I actually felt whole, is once I started to drink. Everything looked bright, even when I was, everything was miserable around me. Everything was okay when I drank. Everything felt good. You know, life is, you know, the worst. You know, alcohol to me was my joy pill, my God, my, you know, my best friend. It never, you know, it never made me feel bad. It always made me feel great. And that's what I always wanted. You know, after being abused so much by my mother and her boyfriends and told I was worthless and never amount to anything and I was a piece of crap and I'll never achieve anything in life and, you know, and all the beatings, you know, alcohol was the only thing that made me feel confidence. And I stayed with it. Even though towards the end, you know, it pretty much stabbed me in the back. It helped me make the wrong choices, the bad decisions, the real bad mistakes. I became, I went to boys' prison when I was 15 years old.
What was the reason for that? Why did you go?
I was a kleptomaniac, drug addict, thief. Committed many robberies, burglaries. Yeah, because I was a young kid, and I was going to junior high, and I would skip school just to go down different streets to find houses that weren't, you know, they weren't answering the front door. I'd go to the back door and kick in or go through the window, and I'd always go with some, you know, classmates, too. You know, they were just like me, you know, real hoods, as we were called anyways, and, you know, and just steal what we could. I was just, and that made me feel good. It made me feel good just like alcohol, just doing something, having stuff. I just like stuff. You know, like somebody else's stuff. Anything I don't have to work for. You know, I thought this was cool. I got this car, this TV, this ring, this motorcycle. You know, whatever it was, these clothes, this thing. You know, it's just there's a thing I was trying to, I was feeling inside me, but it made me feel good. That's all I know how to do is feel good, even if it hurts somebody else. That's all I care about. As long as I felt good, even no matter what. So it started. You know,
you had a gang. You were with a gang, right? Was that it, Steve? You had a gang going with this, or? Long
yeah, walk. I was actually, I was with a bunch of hoods, you know, just like neighborhoods, but, you know, we were called hoods back in the late 70s, I think it was, 78, 77, 78, 79, 80. And then when I got out, and I got kicked out of, I only graduated the seventh grade. I flunked eighth grade. They went to the eighth grade again. Then they pushed me to ninth grade. Just to keep pushing me forward. Then I flunked ninth grade. Then I repeat ninth grade. Then they pushed me into 10th grade. And I got into a fight on 10th grade about the third week. You know, that was a very uncool fight that, you know, really made a bad thing happen. And so I had to, you know, I got kicked out. So I went to street school. And I didn't last long there. You know, I started dealing and smoking. And I met a biker. A girl that was actually related to one of the bikers, you know, in Oklahoma. And I started hanging out with them. And then I started working at this place. It's a strip club called Cat Patch on Admiral. It used to be, but it was owned by the Rogues, the bikers. And I was only 19 then. Like I said, I flunked many times. So anyways, I was 19. And I was working as a day manager, you know, just basically beer and stuff like that at Cat Patch. I worked there for quite a while, and then I got too notorious and dealing, and I decided to straighten up. You know, actually, I got in this big fight at this bar at Lewis on my birthday of all places, you know, on my birthday. And I go in for, you know, public drunk and everything, and me and a few other guys. And that sobered me up for some reason. I don't know why, but I got out of there and said, you know, the judge says, you know, okay, you got drunk, you did this, you did this, why? I said, it's my birthday, Judge. What do you expect? You know, I said, nicely. And he smiled. He said, okay, find me like $25. That was back then. You know, that's it. But I sobered up, and I went to South Padre Island, Texas. And I thought, I'll move away, you know, geographical locations. I'm sober. I'm going to move down here, even though, I don't like my mom. But, you know, I'm older now. I'm bigger now. and I lived near her, and you know, and on her island, so to speak, because that's what she called it, you know, because she was an alderman and she lived next door to the mayor and all this stuff. So I got two jobs, so I became a workaholic. Right? I was not drinking and drugging, right? But I was working day and night, day and night, day and night, day and night, day and night. You know, young during the summer and everything. I was sober and everything, but then I started, you know, finding out the price of what drugs were down there and alcohol in Mexico across the border. So unfortunately, I started becoming a dealer and transporting, you know, from state to state, back and forth every weekend, you know, driving immediately from there, back, forth, back, forth, back, forth, back, forth, till, you know, eventually I got caught. You know, I mean, that just, you know, I was about 20 years old and I had everything and, you know, and it was making a lot of people in the neighborhood jealous and resentful, you know, stuff like that. So somebody told me, basically, you know. I'm assuming that's really what happened. But actually, I got arrested. It's in the Tulsa World. I got arrested for kidnapping, armed robbery, extortion, hostage at Willow Creek Apartments on 71st in Yale back in December 24th of 1985. And because I beat those charges, two months later, I guess it was, because the witnesses never showed up and they never found them, they followed me for a couple of months, and I'm assuming that's probably what really happened. Just, you know, they just busted me because they followed me and watched who was coming in and out of my condo. And from what I heard, one old friend got pulled over about to leave my house, and he told on me. So, and then the other, there was four of us. I was so-called the ringleader, but there was four of us that did the kidnapping and stuff, and the other three turned state evidence against me and, you know, signed papers to, you know, said that they would, you know, turn against me. But they didn't, because I was able to make sure we didn't have to go to court. I persuaded the witnesses not to go to court or whatever. So they just left. So anyways, we didn't go to court, but I'm assuming they followed me around, and that's what they did and busted me in March of 1986. And then I went to prison in November, I believe it was, of 1986 for the first time. Now, there I was, I only had a couple of months sentence because there was only possession of marijuana and cocaine. So, of course, back there in the 80s and stuff, you know, and I think it was Reagan that was during that time of, you know, saying no to drugs and stuff. He was really against it. So it was my first felony that I was got sentenced to, not arrested for, but sentenced to. But he took, you know, really hard, you know, I didn't get no probation, or there was no such thing as drug court or anything like that. So I went straight to prison. I was supposed to do a little bit of time, but unfortunately, stupid me, young, dumb, and full of it, you know, walked into prison at 21 and said, hey, 22.
I'm all that in a bag of chips. I remember you had mentioned that you got involved with the Aryan Brotherhood while you were there.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was saying. I walked in there. I was almost to turn 20, I guess, or 23. No, 23. So I walked in, and the first thought was, you know, I ain't going to get raped in no shower. You know, I've seen the old movies. I don't know nothing. So I walked up to the two of the biggest guys with tattoos, you know, from sleeved out and everything, and became friends with them. You know, I'll do it. You know, I'm going to hang out with you guys. And I listen to their garbage, you know, and everything. Yeah, you know. So I'd hang out with them. And next thing you know, I'm Mr. Okie Doke from Oklahoma. You know, they tell me, go collect a couple box of cigarettes to that guy, that punk that owes me. You know, and I said, okie doke. And I'd go, you know, do it. And, you know, unfortunately, and I did. And I got a lot of trouble. I got a lot of documentation trouble. In other words, I got a 9 assault and batteries just within the first 2.5 years of being locked up. And I got arrested for possession with intent while in, and also assault to an officer, not a police officer, but a guard, because I was stupid. You know, they tell me, we'll go, okay, go do this. Okay, let's go. You know, let's do this. So I started, you know, a racial riot at Jackie Brandon Corrections, and thus I went to the walls. That's McAllister State Penitentiary. No biggie. It looks like huge Alamo, from what I heard, a lot bigger than the one in San Antonio we were talking about. But anyways, I was there, and I thought I was cool. You know, here I am, and I'm walking the walls. I'm state, you know, Big Mac. Everybody talks about it in Oklahoma. You know, I'm on F2 run, death row. It's just right on the, you know, right on the same road, just the other, the deeper half of it. The upper half is, you know, just regular lockdown. I'm on death row, walk on death row. I'm so cool. You know, ain't nobody touch me, disrespect me, talk crap to me. You know what I mean? And then slam. I hear the bars lock me in. And I look out these bars, and it's chicken wire, too, on the other side, and this big, huge glass, and this 30-foot concrete wall, and these two guard towers. I'm like, holy crap. You're right. Ain't nobody going to do it. Because you're going to be alone for a long time. That's the first time I had an intellectual thought, thinking, you know what? I got a problem. I don't know what it is, but I think I got a problem. And I had no other clue. I didn't know it was alcohol yet. Nobody told me alcohol and drugs was my problem, you know? I thought it was the judge or the police, the people that snitched on me or my girlfriend or anything else but something I actually enjoyed, which was drugs and alcohol. So when I got out, first thing I did, stupid me, when I got out of Stringtown. Actually, we got in a riot in Stringtown. I'm sure probably some of my listeners know about that on my Facebook that I told about. Was in Stringtown. We actually burned Stringtown down. And it was a racial riot, too. It was pretty well publicized in, you know, in the nation because it was a pretty hideous one. It was a racial. It was bull crud. Anyways, so I stayed in even longer, but they rebuilt it. And I actually discharged from there. I walked out the gates. There was no parole. And what do? After all these years of just drinking basically homebrew in prison, you know, this girl picks me up, a friend of mine's girlfriend picks me up and gives me a bottle of wild turkey right there in the parking lot. And I'm sitting there down in it in front of the guard tower on purpose, you know, flipping them off because he's saying, hey, yo, Cropper, get off the property, get off. And I'm flipping them off, showing them my discharge papers, holding the bottle and drinking. What are you going to effing do, man? What you going to effing do? You know, so that's started my whole, I mean, I just how stupid it was. All these years in prison, I get out, I drink, I drive all the way to Tulsa. Well, not, the girl drives all the way to Tulsa, a couple hours or so away. I pull in the promenade mall, and we pull next to a police car that's sitting there in the, you know, drive, you know, the mall parking lot. There's no police officer in there, but I'm not even sure if I even looked, because I don't remember. I was drunk. All I remember is the stupidity of walking up to the police car and pissing all over the car. I'm only out of prison after years, a couple hours of freedom, and here I am pissing on a police car. I mean, and I don't think I even checked to see if there was a cop in there. You talk about insanity.
Oh,
you know, I'm trying to go back to prison or something, you know? It's just crazy of alcohol, what it does to my mind. It really does. It's like, so then I started going out, you know, I got my first Harley, you know, and then I went to Hog Alley is a bar here in Tulsa that's, you know, well-known, and it's owned by the Mongols, and started hanging out with the Mongols and becoming best friends with the Mongols and become Mongol, and then start selling to the Mongols from Matamoros and Boca Chica, Mexico, and transporting me for the next 4 years and getting even more crazier and stupider and crazy. But, and it wasn't until I actually got busted a few years later, you know, when the SWAT team come roaring in through the windows of the, and the kicking in the doors. And this is the second time. The first time they did it back in March of 86, they did the same thing. I'm flying through windows and doors, you know. And here it is, you know, doing it all over again in a different place, you know, come flying into windows, concussion bombs, blowing the windows out and all this stuff. And I'm going back to prison. I'm like, oh, Jesus, here we go. You know, and ain't no way I'm getting out of this. Busted cold, 23 and a half pounds of marijuana, you know. And I, no matter if I convinced the judge that it was for medicinal purposes, he wouldn't have believed me. You know what I mean? So I try, right? So I finally accept, okay, I'm going back to prison. The first thing I'm going to do, if I'm going to make sure I get me a hottie, they'll come visit me like all my other bros in prison had that I didn't have. So what I do, I go look shopping for a girl at the best place in there. Where? A shop, you know, strip club. Yeah. Well, that didn't last long, you know. I mean, but I paid a lot of money to last my sentencing for 2 years. 2 years I was out on bond, drinking, drugging, going crazy, getting even more stupider, till finally I got so stupid. She left me, you know, for another bouncer, basically. I mean, another guy who was a bouncer. And, of course, I was a biker. So what do? I'm going to change geographical locations again. I pack up all my luggage and all my Harley, two bottles of whiskey, drive all the way to Oklahoma City to a liquor store to get more whiskey, and I drive back, you know, swearing I'm going to go to California and change my life because it's her and it's, you know, all this. That's why I'm such a mess. And I'm roaring back, you know. And then here's what's funny. I pull into Tulsa, right, late night. I pull up to the Quick Trip right on the other side of the toll gate. I'm yelling, screaming on the phone, you know, the real phones, you know, they had in front of Quick Trips, you know, not cell phone, you know. I'm yelling, screaming, you know, this big black biker all dressed in black from head to toe, chaps, Harley, everything. Right, well, of course, who can blame the Quick Trip guy for getting nervous and calling the police? Well, luckily, next door was a donut shop. There was the police. Imagine that. So I see police officers walking over towards
you're home away from home. Away from home.
So these police officers are walking over towards me, you know, and I'm looking at them, and I'm telling my girl, hold on, you know, I got to call you back. And I go, what up? You know, I'm drunk, you know, I'm slurring. And they go, what's going on? I just like spilling my guts or something. You know what I mean, to them. You know, I'm going back to prison. My girl did this, that. I mean, I'm being sponsored by police officers pretty much. I'm crying to them like I'm my fire chief. You know, put me out. I mean, I'm going nuts here. You know, and all this officer reaches behind him. You know, he ain't grabbing a gun. He grabs his card and says, here, yeah, when you go, before you go to prison or when you get out, if you want to sell your Harley, let me know. And that's it. That's it. That's it. That's all they had. They didn't say, okay, get in the car, public drunk, or anything. I was wondering what would happen if they had done that, honestly, if my life would have been any different. So what I did right then, I got on my Harley. I wore down I-44 as fast as I can. I don't know why. You know, just floored out, drunk, you know, screaming, hollering. And a truck pulls off I-69, you know, on a loop that joins I-44, and he pulls in front of me. And I slam on the brakes, and all I remember is crunch and flying into the bridge. And I hit the bridge. And of course, I'm not wearing a helmet. And that's why I got all these scars on top of my skull is from that. And bang, you know. And all I remember.
You think that could have been causatory to the tumor?
You know, I've had them investigate that. I really have. And they're not sure yet. They really, after all this time, they're not sure. They're like waiting for different times and periods, you know, of, I don't know what's called, chemical imbalance or whatever.
Right.
I think it is, you know, because I laid there in the grass in the pit, you know, screaming. That's when I remember pulling grass with my hands and digging a hole with my heels into the ground. This officer, where, you know, I was looking at these officers, and of course, you know, my head's wide open, and I'm in the ground, and I'm thinking the infections and whatever could have. I really do. But that's when I went out. And then, and this is what changed my life. Now, remember, I did nothing about God Almighty, HP, and, you know, Allah or any all that stuff. But my first experience was, next thing you know, I see myself, and I'm wearing white as white can be. I've got my leather on, but it's all purely white. And I'm just checking myself out. And I'm looking around, and I don't see nothing. I look in front of me. There's this huge, huge, beautiful, awesome light shining straight at me. And I see a silhouette of many people way in the distance. I don't know, probably maybe 50 yards. But I can see the silhouette of their shoulders and their head, but not color or anything else, just that there was people, you know. And I was just checking myself out, and I'm white. Why am I wearing white leather? And this person walked out towards me, you know, and it doesn't get much praise for me saying this, you know, in this 12-step community. You know, it really doesn't. But unfortunately, you know, for them, but it's the truth for me because it just happened. You know, this person walked towards me, you know, and looked at me, and I looked at him. And we looked at each other, and out of my own mouth, I said, oh, fuck. It's that Jesus guy. What the fuck's he want? And like some people at churches would say, okay, you said the F word. You're going to hell. Get out of here. Close down. Pool. Get out of the pool. You know, no. He just tilted his head and raised up his finger, and that's it. And I can only assume that meant one more time. You know what I mean? It sure didn't mean you're number one. But that's when, boom, I felt this hard hit in my back. And when I looked up, I saw this operating light, and I come flying forward. I'm laying down. I didn't know. I'm flying forward, and when I flying forward, I'm like, what the hell, what the hell, what the hell? And I see these two police officers about 20 feet down, and my dad standing between them, you know, crying. And they come walking towards me, and I'm thinking, oh, crap, police, you know. And I'm looking, I'm seeing my pants, my leathers, and my boots, right? That's all I could see. And I'm thinking, oh, crap, okay, where's my gun? Where's my drugs? You know, where's my bike? You know, and I'm hollering, you know, what the hell? And then I feel this guy grab me by the ears, pulls me down really hard, you know, and says, and yells at the nurse, put him under. What's he doing away? Put him under. Put him under. She's running over, and she's scrambling, and she's trying to stick something in my arm. It's because, Mr. Crawford, do you know where you are? Do you know where you are? You know, let's talk about super denial and don't know crap, right? I go, yeah, I'm in a hospital. I'm visiting a friend, and my Harley's parked outside. I haven't got a clue. I mean, I knew how to lie even if it was wrong. You know what I mean? That's, you know. So then
You could do it subconsciously. You could lie subconsciously. Yeah.
Without a problem. You know, even after visiting Jesus, right? I'm still right there. You know, heck with the burning bush. I mean, I'm still lying my way out of something. You know what I mean? So, you know, I saw the police officers come over and put their hands on my heels, you know, and I'm starting to feel a little drowsy, whatever, you know, the warm feeling in my arm. And I look up that light, and seriously, as I can say it, you know, I look up this light, and I say, oh, that's the light. I saw. Oh, that's the light. I saw. Okay, guys, that was a weird dream. That was a heck of a light I saw. Then I heard this voice inside me goes, I am not that light. I am God. And I swear to God, I come flying up again, yelling stupidly, did y'all hear that? Did y'all hear that? Did y'all hear that? What was that? Who was that? And they're like, man, what did you put him under? And they grab me again, grab my ears, slam me back down. Officers grab my legs and put their hands on my chest to hold me still. Because apparently they had my head wide open. You know, they were doing all the, you know, chiseling and all this stuff. And part of my skull was open on the top and everything, you know. And the guy, you know, was yelling at the nurse, put him under, I said. Stay still, stay still. I said, no, then I went out. Next thing I woke up, I don't know, I don't remember when I was coherent, maybe it was a week later in the hospital. I remember these police officers, you know, telling me that I denied a breathing test. Check this out. I just want to let you know that you have been, you know, arrested for a DUI because you refused a breathalyzer. When did I refuse that? When you're laying on the ground, you asked me to breathe into an analyzer while I was there with my skull ripped open, really? You know, and you go, yeah. Oh, okay. You know, thanks.
There's no way you could have done that. I've done a breathalyzer. It takes a lot of energy to do a breathalyzer.
Yeah, I don't even remember. I don't see why they didn't just shove it in my mouth anyways. You know what I mean? If they're really that concerned about it. But apparently, you know, anyway, they wouldn't let me know my driver's license were revoked for 6 months because I denied the breathalyzer, you know. So then we'll go, so they finally, you know, let me go about 2 weeks later. I got a speech impediment problem because of the swelling of the, you know, the brain damage. And they take me time off my sentencing because of my brain damage, you know. So I'd go to court and I'd look like, you know, a Hindu or a Muslim with this big rag around my head and my shoulder holster from where it ripped the ligament off out of my right shoulder and this long leg strap on cast I had on with Velcro straps all the way around it, you know, and I'd walk in and look pathetic and I can't even hardly talk. And so the judge gives me up, I came here something like 4 months of recovery, you know, before I got better. I don't mean 12 step, you know, so. And that was the first time I actually, it was like a week later after I got out, so that's how I was dressed. I saw leather was on, too, and still looking like this, you know, in this court, for God's sake. You know, I'm sitting there, I'm drinking, watching football game, speech impediment, I had a brain problem where I can only focus on one thing. Like, if I'm talking to you, and I'm looking at you and talking, and say, Harold is screaming in my ear, I couldn't turn. And focus on them. I didn't know that at that time. That was later brought to my attention, you know, later on. But actually, I was watching the football game. I had a drink. My dad just made it. I drank it. I was about to work on my second one when my dad said, just look at you. I said, what do you mean? And you look like a mess, you know. I hope you get okay. What's wrong with me? Because I had a speech problem then. you know, second kind of idea. So what's wrong with me? You know, he goes, the motorcycle accident. And it was like right then I realized I had a motorcycle accident, even after being out for 2 weeks. You know, and I looked at myself. It was like an awakening. I looked at this Velcro cast I had on my leg, and I looked at the shoulder holster. I looked in this little hand mirror that was on the end table of this Hindu-looking hat I was wearing that was a bandage in their thing. And that's when I turned up, and I looked up the ceiling, and I just had my speech was, God, I don't know what I need, but I need something different. Just like the thing in prison. I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue. You know, I know something's wrong with me. I just don't know what it is. And I turned actually to God for the first time. I said, God, I don't know what I need, but I need something different. And right then I heard the same audible voice that let me know there's no difference between AA and church and God. I heard this voice say, go to the nearest church and ask about AA. I had no clue about that AA stuff. I knew about church, you know, from prison and stuff like that. But that the first miracle was that I actually got up and poured that drink out. Didn't even drink it. And I don't know why. If you know us, you know, we drink one drink and it's over. I actually poured my second drink out and I went to bed. I got up the next morning, dressed in my leathers, as always, you know, put on my bandages and stuff, and walked up the street to where there's now, you know, it was still the same group, Miracles group, but I actually worked up the same street at this Presbyterian church that's still there, and walked into this room, you know, to this lady, and boy, she looked at me like, you know, oh my God, you know, the devil just walked in the door, really. Because I walked in, I looked at her, and she goes, can I help you with something? You know, yeah, God told me to come ask you something. Yeah, you know, she's looking at me weird, you know, and I'll never forget it because she was looking at me puzzled, and I was even puzzled back. You know, you sure God asked you? Yeah, God wanted me to come ask you about AA. God told you? And I'm looking at myself like, well, yeah. I said, yeah. Doesn't God talk to you? I mean, thinking, you know, if God can talk to a jackass like me, obviously someone like you he talks to all the time, right? You know, and she went into all this, you know, theology stuff I didn't understand. Well, he talks to me through his word that I meditate, blah, 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 which, of course, my brain cell couldn't handle. And I was like, okay, all I know is he told me to ask you about AA. So she actually had a where's and when, and she handed it to me. And I looked at it, and I looked at the time. I had all the time in the world, you know, and I said, where's this one right here? And she said, tell me exactly where the unanimity group was on 88th and Lewis, which is actually near ORU. I don't know if you ever heard of Oral Roberts University, but it's near, uh-huh. There's this little mini mall, you know, next to it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, so I went to there. And it was far away, so I actually called, you know, some of my friends, you know, some of the Mongols, and told them if they'd give me a ride. And they said, where? You know, I told them, I need to go to AA. They didn't ask me. I don't remember them asking me why or what for. They just makes you know, you know, they're roaring up, you know, in front of in the church parking lot. There was only about six of them, you know, but, you know, and I got on the scooter thing, and, you know, I'm sitting in it, and, you know, and I got these crutches and things, and, you know, because I got this long strap on Velcro cast thing, and I'm driving up, you know, at the unanimity group, you know, and there's six of us, you know, seven of us now, you know, driving up to an AA meeting, driving the parking lot, and there's a bowling alley connected, still there, River Lanes bowling alley, you know, so they pulled up, you know, and like all these people at the unanimity group, you know, looking at me, and I didn't think nothing of it, but they looked at me and looked at us, and they walked me up the door, you know, and I walked in. You know, and this old timer, it took me a long time to understand exactly what it meant. No kidding. But as I walked in wearing all this bandage stuff, he looked up, he looked at everybody else, and I don't know why God gave me this, but I looked at him and like it zeroed in, and he looked at me weird, and he smiled real big and looked at the group and said, now that's how a newcomer should come to a meeting. And I didn't know what that meant
until later. That meant you were ready. That meant you were ready.
this guy is teachable. We could work with him.
Exactly. And it took me a long time to understand that. I mean, I had my first resentment for Abe, just that person. You know, like, I thought, what do you mean? This hurts feeling like this, being like this. You know, but it took me, it don't matter. You know, but anyways, I finally ended up getting better, and I did. And so the judge, gave me a free pass to go to jail. You know, and I remember standing in front of that judge, and my lawyer said, well, all Mr. Crawford wants to do is take his 12-step, his 12 and 12 in his big book with him. And the judge said, so be it. Come back in 30 minutes or 15 minutes after break, and we'll finish the sentencing. And so I remember going in that bathroom and getting on my knees, seriously, in front of the toilet and praying and kind of crying. And I was crying a little bit, teary. And, okay, actually, I was crying a lot. And I was like, God, I don't understand why you saved me from death and then get me sober and then send me like some innocent sheep back to the wolves that I used to love, you mean, my old brotherhood people and stuff, knowing I'll turn right back in hell. What was the use in all this AA garbage and church stuff, knowing I'm going back to prison like this? You know, and that's when I felt a presence on my shoulder that in this little whisper. And whatever it was, I just felt this little verse I remember, but this feeling big bag that says, son, I'll never leave you or forsake you. I'll be right there. So I kind of, got out and walked in and sat down and stepped up and got sentenced to 15 years and went to prison.
Mm.
So my third time of incarceration and then, of course, things, kind of went crazy in the beginning. You know, did some crazy stuff that, wasn't proud of, but in prison, actually, I grew a marijuana plant, while I was in the Department of Corrections grounds at Thunderbird Corrections in Oklahoma City as a work release. This doesn't sound wise. Okay, this is the second time I'm arrested for marijuana and drugs, right? So I go to Enid, Oklahoma, Crabtree. I walk in there, and they said, okay, we're going to give you Votech. Okay, what you got? How about horticulture? Okay.
I like that.
What kind of horticulture? Okay. I'm having a brain fart. I'm having a brain fart. What's that? You quickly grow vegetables in horticulture.
Hydroponic?
God, thank you. I don't know why I'm having a brain fart. It must be late. Hydroponics. They give me hydroponics, and I step back thinking, oh, y'all are testing me. I had a little AA in me too, but I'm thinking, oh, y'all test me. Y'all gonna give me to grow my pot faster so you can bust me faster. So you're gonna teach me how to do it, So that's what I did. I worked in the hydroponics greenhouse, but it was about the same year of the Oklahoma City bombing, where the Murray building was blown up. I'm sure you heard of that back then in
1999.
Oh, sure. That happened, and they had a state's park director. The governor sent out to Enid to basically get a lot of us Votech horticulture people and landscape, because I was part of my Votech, to actually come be shipped from minimum security prison to halfway house. That's what that was, Thunderbird, work release to work on the memorial and all that other stuff surrounding the Murray building and everything. So, of course, me, old behavior, I go off the grounds by the railroad tracks and figure out, I wonder if I can grow pot out here. I never really did. I was never into that, even when I was afraid growing it, But I thought I would with my skills, So I let it alone for 4 months, and I came back with a friend and we're going through the woods and we're looking for it, and everybody's heard about it. No one's found it, Then I look over at Jack, and he's saying, I can't find it. I said, Jack, look next to you. And he looks at a tree that's 7 feet tall, pure marijuana plant, in Department of Corrections ground. I was a bellwether.
Really?
Everybody loved me there at Thunderbird. Why? Because they couldn't afford it, right? Buying little caps. Well, so I was just giving it away. I stripped it. We stripped it. Let it dry out and then just start giving it away to everybody. All summer long, everybody was fried as hell, And that's what got them mad. Both, you know, the Thunderbird got mad at me and sent me back to bowling up the minimum because they were trying to catch me doing this, that, and the other, and they couldn't do it. So I come in from church and an AA meeting of all places. All right, I've already dabbled a little. You know, I've already drank quite a lot. I actually experimented with crack for the first time that summer at Thunderbird. God, I'm there. I pray for those people that are on crack. That's the first drug I ever did that the first second I did it, it just grabbed me and said, you're mine. Alcohol, you know, the crack, oh, my God. I feel sorry for anybody that's on crack. Really,
yeah.
Seriously. I mean, after just an hour, I'm taking my jewelry off my neck and say, go give me some more. It's crazy. I was like, oh, my gosh. So within just a month, this relapse, or no, 2 months of this relapse, you know, I'm just like sick. I was trying to read a paragraph out of the A grapevine, and I couldn't. I read it like 16 times, and I couldn't even understand it. It was, I was like, what? And then when I come in from church with a couple of the guys, and they even the AA meet, this guard looked at me and goes, okay, Mr. Crawford, we're sending you back to up the ladder of minimum security. I said, you are. We're sending you to Bowley. Well, I remember Bowley has a vision quest. It's like a, you know, a drug program. So I actually said, cool. He goes, huh? Cool. So he puts handcuffs on me nicely, and I said, are you all right? Yeah. Can I say goodbye, everybody? He actually, yeah, go ahead. So I actually went, it's like a Motel 6 converted into a work release. That's what it looks like, you know, that Thunderbird did. So I'd go door to door, handcuffs at about 9 o'clock at night, and you know my fellow buddies would be, dude, what are you doing with handcuffs on? You know, I'm just saying goodbye. I'm going to Bowley up the ladder, and they're letting you do this? Yeah, actually, I had no guard with me either. That was weird. You know, that was really weird. Of course, they probably didn't figure I'd run too far with handcuffs, but I was saying goodbye, and everybody was like, "You're actually happy?" I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. For the first time, I get that. I'm really sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, I was sober and clean for a little while. Then I relapsed in drugs, alcohol, and crack, you know, at that work release and stuff. And I understood, I'm really sick and tired of this. I've just
let me ask
and
you
that
this.
Was November 6th in 19.
Let me ask you this, Steve. Did you work the steps with a sponsor? Had you worked the steps yet?
Yeah.
You did. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's relapse.
Only
okay.
Prior
go
to
on.
That relapse? No. Prior to relapse? No. No.
I just came across this. If you've worked the steps, and then it's a relapse. If you drink or drug before you work the steps, it's a slip. Did you ever hear that? Put it that way?
Yeah. I've heard that. I have heard that. I can relate now. Yeah, I can. No, I was too egotistical and proud, you know, to get a sponsor. You know, I did the meetings. You know, I would occasionally read the book.
Occasionally.
You know, but I the meetings was my salvation, so to speak. I would do meetings. I'd be addicted to meetings. You know, before I went to prison, you know, I would read a lot and I would go to church a lot, but I would easily slip back to the other stuff, the obsessive behavior of like working out 8 hours a day on the weights, and going to school or the Votech and working out while I was, you know, I was obsessed in other things, but helping somebody else, like what we call service work that you mentioned as one of the tools, you know. And I was still had issues with black people, you know, and still hanging out with tattooed people, you know, as I call them. But actually, we were Aryans back then. Well, I was, but they still around. I don't know what I'm talking like that for. But anyway, but I'll tell you what changed me from Aryan, and this is a good share in my recovery. When I went blind in that infirmary at Lexington Prison, for 2 months, my friend, Brother James, he was an inmate, but he worked in the infirmary. So, you know, taking out trash, mopping floors, cleaning up here, you know, all that stuff, you know, inmate. And, you know, he was really helpful. He helped walk me to the church, or we walked the ball field, you know, or he would read to me, or he helped me write letters, you know, and he'd help me go to the canteen stuff. So we became really good friends for 2 months. And then I started going out to the weightlifting yard because my muscles started getting bad, better, because I lost a lot of weight. So I gained a lot of weight back, some starvation and everything. So I got a little stronger, so I went up to the weight pile, and I was working out there for about a week. And then I heard this voice, a couple of voices I've heard before. I remembered, and I said, Kenny, is that you? Sidewalk, is that you? And they go, yeah, what's up, Rock? Well, they used to be my nickname. Hey, man. Hey, so I told them about, hey, man, I went blind from surgery. Yeah, we heard. You heard. What'd you hear from? We seen you around. You seen me around where? Well, we seen you around the ball field and, the church and stuff. Why come y'all ain't said nothing? We heard you quit drinking, and do drugs and stuff like that, and we didn't want to mess you up or anything, And you just got went blind too, We don't get you off in that stuff, again. So what are you talking about, dude? We were in riots together, and we were, we were gangbanged together basically, and all this stuff. We started all these fights, with and sex and stuff like this, and from prison to prisons and stuff. I was well known for being a jerk, Aryan. You guys ain't said a word, you said yo or anything. Well, you've been hanging out with Butcher Boy, so we figured we wouldn't bother you, since you're hanging out with Butcher Boy. Who's Butcher Boy? Brother James. Why are you calling Butcher Boy? Oh, he's an OG from Oklahoma City. So, he's an OG. I said, so, well, you know he's off death row, don't you? Well, I heard some about it, but he doesn't talk about it. He just says he doesn't talk about it. Well, you know why he's off death row, or why he went to death row, don't you? No. Well, he got in a gang war in Oklahoma City, got shot in the neck, by the other gang, and, of course, he got out himself, got drunk, and his buddies, whatever, they got out. There's just, his neck, whatever, and he got better, and, about a month or so later, he got better, and he went looking for the guy that shot him, Well, we couldn't find him because that guy ended up robbing a liquor store in Oklahoma City and went to prison. So Butcher Boy went and actually killed that guy's brother on purpose to go to prison to kill that guy for shooting him in front of his buddies.
Wow.
Brother James, isn't that college dude? He's not a college guy. What are you talking about? He's already done 15 years, so... He talks like a college guy. No. Wow, I didn't know it was that. I knew it was, I heard that, but he didn't talk about it. Yeah, he just got his sentence commuted 3 years ago from death row to life without. Well, he don't even sound like his, mind, mouth, mood, attitude. I mean, he's always happy and helpful and encouraging and positive. Yeah. Because, he's black. I said, what? You know he's a nigger.
So, and you're an Aryan, right? You're an Aryan Brotherhood. Yeah. And now the guy that you're hanging out with turns out to be black.
Black. Yeah, and I go, a nigger. Brother James. Butcher Boy. The guy that talks like a college kid, he's older than me, but college dude. Yeah, so I walked over to the other end of the weight pile, Hey, Brother James, I goes, yeah. How long you been fucking black? I ain't lying,
and
man.
Said,
I'm lying, I'm dying.
And he said.
He laughed just like y'all did. He did. He giggled as well since I was born. And I go, why the hell did I say some stupid stuff like that? I'm just in shock. I was like, how dare you not tell me? Don't you know who I think I am? You should have told me this, that you're black. I would, So I had a decision to make. So, I was like, yeah, I guess you would be. So I was like real quiet, and I was thinking this whole time, and everything. And so I went back to the infirmary, and I was there for about a day or two pondering this stuff, He'd come in a couple of times to do his deal, chores, whatever, and say hi. I say, hey, what's up? Are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. Then I finally just hit me, For 2 months, this guy has read to me, wrote for me, you know, walk ball field, work, you know, he actually helped set up the weights for me when I worked out, walked me to church, walked me to schoolhouse, walked me to the mailroom, walked me to the canteen, you know, stuff like that. And all my Aaron friends in my most dire need of friendship, being totally blind in prison after a botched surgery, have chose not to be around me because I hang around a black guy.
Mm. Boy, that's an eye-opener.
Hell with them. Yeah, I said, the hell with that. I choose to like who I choose to like. I choose to hang out who I choose to hang out with. I choose to grow up. I'm not 21 anymore. I choose to grow up and decide who I want to hang out with. And so that was my decision to, you know, quit the Aryan Brotherhood and hang out with who I choose to hang out with. What religion, what culture, whatever, it's my choice from now on. Nobody chooses for me and decides for me on this deal right here because you guys have done me wrong, just like alcohol. You guys are my best friend, and when I need you the most, you stab me in the back. Alcohol, same thing. When I need you the most, you send me to prison by making bad choices and wrong decisions. So that changed my whole concept. Well, the sad part was I did 2 years in prison blind, and I got out 2 years to the month, September of 97 to September of 99, I got out. And then 1 year later, Brother James is calling me every 2 weeks, and I'm recording his messages on cassette because back then they still had cassette. And if any of y'all don't know what cassettes are, call your sponsor. But anyways, I would basically use cassettes to, you know, record him because, you know, he was cool. And he always had all his sponsorship, mentor, spiritual advising, you know, things that were just like, you know, I would always, you know, I wanted, you know. So I record him, and then they did call me after 2 weeks. So I called the prison, and I said, and got passed over to the chapel because he actually kind of worked part-time there at the chapel, you know, for them, you know. Little stuff there, here and there, and whatever. And I asked the chaplain, hey, where's Brother James? He was supposed to call me. He says, oh, you didn't know? You didn't hear? I said, what? Well, he died 2 weeks ago. What do you mean he died 2 weeks ago? Well, he had a stomach tumor for the last 9 months. And they didn't do anything for him. Well, apparently it was stage four. And it was killing him for the last year. You mean the whole year I've been out? Yeah. Now, one time did he tell me that. He would say, well, I got to get a phone. I'm kind of feeling weak. Well, I'm just, you know, just feel tired. That's all he ever said. Never told me that he actually looked like an Ethiopian, you know, pregnant in the belly and just down to skin and bones when he died, throwing up his last bowel movements from what the chaplain told me. That's something about how bad he looked. And he actually died. And that's the first time that I actually fell onto my knees and cried snot tears for a male, let alone a black male. And I said, why? I was really hoping my buddy would get out and we'd do AA together and church together and all this stuff, and everything. I swear to God, I just like, you know, just like, wow. I mean, what am I losing it for somebody that, you know, wow, you know, now all of a sudden I heard this voice. I swear to God, I don't care how theologian people think they are. I just remember this voice inside me that sounded just like him. It says, don't sweat the small stuff. I'll meet you at the gate.
There you go.
And right then, I cut my tears off, seriously. And I sniffed down then when I mentioned it, you know, the story of Brother James, but I cut my tears off, stood up, pointed at the ceiling and said, I will. I'll meet you at the gate, and I will do what I can to help people see the things you helped me see spiritually. And so thus, I started my journey in the year 2000 out of prison by starting the first AA meeting at the Tulsa Regional Medical Center on the 7th floor for kids that are suffering with suicidal or homicidal thoughts. Started the first boys' home, boys' prison at Sand Springs, called Greater AA meeting there.
Now he dies. Butcher boy dies, right? So, and you're devastated. You get a spiritual, another spiritual bump. Evidently, God has got something in mind for you. There's no doubt about it. I'm sure you have no doubt either. I mean, it's just like he does everything but sending you Western Union telegrams. So now, okay, he dies. So now, do you find a sponsor? Do you go to AA? What are you doing now? You're working your steps. How did you find your sponsor?
Okay.
How'd you do that?
Glad you asked. Great part of my story is this lady called Zola Humphrey from Oklahoma City, 77 years old, if anybody's listening. 77 years old, would go 50 miles with two male companions to Lexington Prison and take a meeting. Every Tuesday, those 2 years I was in prison. So I got to witness service work in action and hearing people talk AA that are in prison, you know, talk about AA, talk about the steps, you know, that read the book because people in prison didn't have time, or there's too many religious people in prison that believe in AA, you know, it's a cult, or, oh, you have to choose a higher power, so it can't possibly be anything related to Christianity, you know, that stuff, you know. And there's only eight of us inmates, you know, of about, I don't know, 600-700, I don't remember, you know, in prison that went every Tuesday. But I would hear Zola. Well, she gave me this piece of paper, so you call these two people in Tulsa that I know of, and asked them help. One was a male, one was a woman. The male never answered. Always wonder what happened if he would answer. He never answered my phone call for a week. The woman did, Shirley B. And I called her, and she became my first temporary sponsor for a month. After that, she actually sponsored a guy named Bobby. So I, you know, asked him if he'd sponsor me, and he said he would. So he kind of helped me. He helped me deal with a lot. First 17 months in Tulsa before I moved, you know, doing the steps, you know, getting into action, you know, getting things, what I basically was talking about earlier, and much more. So
How long did it take him to get you through the steps? How long did you take?
Actually, no, his way was a lot longer. You know what I mean? I don't know why. He didn't read the book, and I was more in need of a friend in AA, you know, because I had to stop playing the old playgrounds, you know. Well, anyways, I got out of prison, I had nobody that I knew, nobody. Everybody was bikers or drug dealers or strippers or whatever, you know. You know what I mean? All I knew was nobody. All I had was this phone number. So then I became him. So, you know, and it would, me and him would go to meetings, you know, and he would talk about the book, and he would talk about the book. You know, my experience was actually in prison, those 2 years, listening on cassette, the big book, and listening to speak. That's all I did for 12 hours a day. I mean, everything, hermeneutical, hermeneutical, theological, philosophical, psychological, you know, AA this, speakers that, all this on cassette. You know, I was blessed to have a spot in the schoolhouse in a cubicle where I did nothing but sit there and listen to a cassette player. You know, besides lifting weights, going to the church, that's all I did was listen to all this stuff. So I listened to the big book, and I listened to the steps, and I listened to speakers and, you know, cassettes and stuff. Because the church closed down passing out recording or cassette players to inmates because they would take the engine out to make tattoo guns. So they had these thousands of cassettes, but they would not check out any of the cassette players. You had to come to the church to listen. No one really would. So they actually gave me permission to keep a cassette player and any cassettes I wanted, which I had hundreds, in my cell. And I would take these, and that's all I did. For 2 years, I was reprogramming the mind. And I did not know it, not till later, but I was reprogramming the mind. I would, every day, all these images, whenever someone talks, you know, just like if you say red dog, I don't think R-E-D-D-O-G, right? What do? You think of a four-legged, hairy animal that's red. You picture it. You image it, right? Same thing in the words I was hearing. See what I'm saying? That was my TV. So what I was putting in my brain through my ear gate, you know, since I had no eye gate, you know, was all these speakers, you know, and books. You know, that was everything.
So that's how you worked the steps. Is that it? Did you formally work the steps? Did you do a written fourth step?
I did it on my cassette. I did it on a recorder.
they actually allowed me to have a recorder, and I did mine on a cassette tape, and I shared it with Brother James. So I did this step with Brother James, so I shared him a lot of my secrets. And I ain't kidding. I was nervous about sharing some of my stuff. I had some really, you know, bad stuff like everybody does, and I was nervous, and I let him hear it, right? And he didn't make a word. He didn't make a sound. Of course, I couldn't see nothing. And I'm moving my hand in front of me a little bit to see if he left or something, you know, whatever. And then I kept on remembering who actually I was sharing my story with. I mean, my God, he's sicker than I am. I mean, to be in prison the way he went to prison, you know what I mean? So I turn it off, and I go, so what do you think? You know, he kind of giggled, like, so, and I was like, with ego, what's so funny? You know, and he goes, you think that's sick? Let me tell you something.
Yeah, let me tell you something. Yeah.
Right.
How about your ninth step?
You know, you hear that,
yeah, everybody does that.
Yeah, I mean, have you heard?
Pardon me?
Right. Remember, I always hear that in meetings. You know, I share with a sponsor or somebody, and they always tell me something that's even worse about them.
Yeah,
you know,
always. Good thing about me, when I sponsor somebody, I'm getting to the age now, but it's always been that way. I really don't remember what the guys tell me, you know, or I share some of the stuff that I've done a little just to make them feel comfortable that, you know, it's okay. You know, you're human and we do things that are a little off color. It's okay. You know, don't worry about it. If it's a felony, I usually suggest that they go to someone who has the right of privilege, you know, a lawyer, doctor, an Indian chief, whatever, you know, who has privilege if it's a felony kind of deal. Although I'm good enough, I could sidestep it. But most of the time, I haven't heard anything in 17 years that really said, oh, my goodness, you know, that I haven't heard it yet. So most of the time, you're not going to say anything that hasn't been heard before. And that's the whole point of the confession, is getting it off your chest, you, God, and another human being. And it really works, my experience. How about your ninth step? How did you work the ninth step? Have you worked a ninth step? Did you make amends for all the past crimes and misdemeanors?
I made a lot. Yeah, I had to make a lot of amends with, you know, I had to send a lot of letters because I couldn't, unfortunately, get in my car and drive, you know, to cross states or things, so I'd make phone calls and write letters and make amends. I never got a chance to make amends to, you know, my mother. You know, she actually, when I went blind, it was 2 weeks later, the deputy warden walked in and said, I'm sorry, but your mother called and she sounded like she was pretty drunk, but she said she can't, she doesn't want any letters or cassette recordings or cards sent to her from you, because she said she can't handle having a blind son that's in prison.
Oh, brother. Sorry to hear that.
2 weeks. Yeah, I know. It's pretty
her ego. That was her ego talking, no doubt about it.
And she was a drunk. And what did she do? Remember what I told you about, I called the chaplain to find out about Brother James? Okay. Mm-hmm. I got the phone. Yeah, and I think, well, you know, that's pretty well, you know. My brother calls me, you know, same day, you know, and calls me, I'm sorry. My mother calls me, that's right. So I record her. I record her anyways, you know. This is probably like an hour later. I'm over, so I just click the recording button. So I still got the cassette. So and then she's a little drunk, and she's blaming me. I've been out of prison for a year. She ain't talked to me at all, you know. And she just goes into a rant about blaming me for everything. You, my son, you've damaged my relationship with my son because he won't talk to me no more, my brother Michael. I said, what are you talking about? You know, because you said this, you said, it's true, though, and we mean your son. I'm your son, you know. And she was just stupid. She was crazy. And I said, man, you need to get your life together for real. You know, you're alcohol. I went into my AA spill. You know what I mean? I went to try to help her, you know, and stuff. And I kept the cassette.
She didn't buy it. She's not buying it.
She ain't buying nothing. She didn't pour another drink. You know what I mean? For real. A week later, my brother calls me and says, hey, Steve, just want to tell you, Detective so-and-so called from South Padre Island. Yeah. They found Mom pool of blood in front of our refrigerator. So we, what happened? Since she killed herself.
Oh, that's bad.
How'd she do that? Well, she cut her wrist from elbow to wrist. And she left a note. She said, what did it say? She says, I leave all my loving, I leave all my possessions and what I own to my wonderful only son, Michael Crawford, my brother. Please take care of my poor blind dog, Fuchi or something. Because she had a blind poodle. Ooh. I mean, you thought a blind poodle before you even found your blind son. You know, like stabbed right in the head, you know?
It was her last stab from hell.
Exactly. I didn't shed a tear till like 2 years later when I was sharing. I mean, seriously, I didn't blink, so to speak. All I know is my brother signed everything over to me. You know, there was no will, so I went through probate and all that stuff. So he signed everything and said, here, you take the beach house and everything else she owns. I don't want nothing to do with it. You know, my brother was already financially secure in his computer business and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah,
so
he had enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, good brother.
Yeah, so, well, you're blind and you got SSI, you know, 2000, you know, that's all you got. You take it. You need it more than I do. You know, so, well, okay. You know, thank you, you know, definitely, you know.
Uh-huh. Quite the journey. All right, so now we're in step 10, 11, and 12, so that's your spiritual growth steps. Now, 12, now what do you do to stay in maximum service to God and your fellows? You've got quite the journey. I like to think of it this way. The bigger the sinner, the greater the saint. The further down the scale we have gone, the more we can find these experiences can help others. So the further down you've gone, the greater help you can be. You go along with that?
I like it a lot. I like it a lot.
What do you do?
Because I've been down to the bottom.
You've been down to the bottom. Yeah, so you're ready. You're ready to be of maximum service to God and your fellows. So what do you do?
I do as much service work as I can do. I got my badge, my Department of Corrections badge. You know, I go to prisons. I go to Dick Connors, Hominy, and I go to McAllister even. Joseph Harp in Lexington, and some of the county jails, and a lot of them I go with churches. It's stamped Alcoholics Anonymous because you sign what part of group or faith you're in. Mine's AA, but it's still a Department of Corrections badge. I can go in prison anywhere, so I go with churches too, as well as with anybody that's willing to go to AA. You know, of course, as you know. You know, well, there's a lot of cities that are not really that much into service work. I think, like, out of my city, out of about 700 people, I know the closest prison is 51 miles prison, and only 3 people go. And that has been for the last 3 years. You know, pretty sad that a blind guy can find a way to go. But all these sighted people that are AA that talk all the spiritual guru of self-sacrifice would rather stay in the comfort zone of meetings, you know. But that's their problem. You know, they got to answer God for that one day. So I do prison meetings. I do detox. I do halfway houses. I speak and raise money for National Federation of the Blind, which is still part of my service work to people that are in need. I got the first gold ball event team in Oklahoma, started in Tulsa, here at the Center for the Physically Limited, with a bunch of blind men and women that are trying to go now more state, and also then join up national for USABA Paralympics in 2016. I also do a lot of speaking. I've been to 26 states and many, many countries, and never seen any of it. I mean, talking on radio to you is about the same as talking in front of 20,000 people on the stage with Joyce Myers, which I did. You know what I mean? There's no intimidation of things you can't see. It's like facing your biggest bully. If you can't see him, you ain't got much fear. That's how big he really is. You'll still swing at him.
I have a granddaughter, Claire. I teach her philosophy. She's 9, and she's really good at it. And I tell her, Claire, remember, where there is no fear, there is no danger. And where there is no danger, there is no fear. So you can't see the danger, so there's no fear going and connected to that.
You ever, seriously, it kind of sounds lame, but you know that old comic book hero, The Man of No Fear, Daredevil?
Oh, the Daredevil, sure.
Yeah, that's I've been nicknamed that a lot, you know, because of the things I've done. I'll break it down. I've skydived 14,000 feet over Honolulu. I've climbed the volcanoes of Honolulu. I've ziplined 1,600-foot zipline over the Garden Island of Hawaii, where Jurassic Park was. Not marched, actually, 8 hours through Jurassic Park. Is not a fun journey. You got to carry a stick. Otherwise, you're slipping and sliding because the ground is so moisture. The prehistoric trees, the roots are like steps, stones. It's pretty funny hearing everybody fall and fall. And here I was not falling and holding my girl at the same time. And they finally, after an hour, asked me, why aren't you falling? Well, can't y'all see? Well, yeah, you can. Can't you see the stick that I'm using? I'm using like a Moses stick. I'm sticking in the ground and stepping forward and sticking the ground. So the next thing I know, I'm hearing tree branches being broke, you know, and people are making their own Moses stick, you know. but I've climbed the 900-foot falls of Jamaica. You know, I've actually scuba dived in Bora Bora and got to feel a down Japanese airplane in World War II, 50 feet down. I've even swam and scuba dived in Tahiti and actually got caught by an octopus. Or he caught me, I caught it, whatever. I thought it was seaweed, just kept on, you know, trying to cling itself to me, and I kept trying to peel it off. And the master diver, they call themselves master diver, you know, would grab me, put my left hand on top of this big round thing. And after a while of examining what he was trying to give me feel, then he tapped me, you know, and I'm like, octopus, you know. So I'm going to the top, carrying this octopus on my head. My wife just walked in. I'm talking about the octopus story, and I come to the top of this octopus on my head. I look like, you know, this blind guy wearing dregs. And you hear all these Japanese people in the boat snapping pictures.
Well, that's really quite inspiring. I mean, considering all the things you've done and the people you continue to help. We need to close it down. We're just about running out of time. Harold, do you have any last thoughts?
Well, I just really appreciate hearing about your experiences with Jesus. And I have a lot of friends, and I have experiences myself. And I really value that. I didn't understand much about the Bible or Jesus back in 1987 when I started in AA, but because of people of faith that I've borrowed some faith from along the way, I really am grateful to be a part of the 12-step programs and clean and sober and a follower of Jesus Christ myself. So thanks for sharing all that. I really enjoyed tonight's conversation.
Thank you very much, Harold. I encourage anybody that's listening, if they want to just look for me on Facebook, Steve Crawford, C-R-A-W-F-R-D, Tulsa, Oklahoma. I got like 10,000 pictures of all the crazy Daredevil stuff I've done, from snow skiing in Aspen to surfing and windsurfing and hang gliding, climbing the glaciers of Alaska. You know, all that crazy stuff. So, you know, I do, you know, look at my pictures and say, nah, this blind guy's full of it. Well, just look for me on Facebook.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. And it's really been a pleasure. And you're quite the inspiration. Thank you so much for extending your time to us. Thank you.
Very honored.
And close.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome. You're quite welcome. In closing, I'd like to say Rum Radio and rumradio.org is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. It's the most comprehensive sponsorship information on the web today. So if you need some good sponsorship information and some inspiration and direction, it's rumradio.org. And remember, like usual, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.